Well, good evening. It's nice to be back. Seems like I was just here yesterday. Although the one thing that I forgot, guess what I forgot? A Bible. Never fear, we'll get through this. Not a problem. Right, fellas? Exactly. These are four of my students from my philosophy class. Philosophy, not logic. That's right, yeah. So they drove, what, about an hour and a half to get here? That's impressive. Very impressive. Thanks for coming, fellas. They're like celebrities now. Yeah, exactly. So tonight's talk is, the Gospels will be mentioned, but there'll be much more of an emphasis tonight on the Torah, since that's the next thing that I'm working on. And so we'll kind of have a try to make this as interactive as I can. Ask questions. I like to be able to, people can ask questions whenever they want, not wait till I get done. If you have a question on your mind, you should be able to ask it right then and there, because if you're like me, you'll forget if you don't. So we'll just leave it open for that. We'll take a break, what, about 45 minutes or so, something like that, 40 minutes. And I do, for those who might want to purchase a book, I did obviously bring some books tonight if you want to get one. Bringing a Bible. Very nice. Nice to have a backup. Thank you. So, oddly enough, I'm going to start it tonight by asking you if you have any questions before I kind of kick into gear, because I'm going to be concentrating more on the Old Testament and specifically the Torah tonight, but there will be some allusions to other books of the Bible. To me, when you do something like this, all 73 are open game. That's the way I feel about it. So before we even get started, does anyone have any questions that are on your mind, either from the last talk or just a Bible question in general?
Well,
yes, go ahead.
We have Protestant relatives, and there's always a controversy as to whether the books that we, the extra books, extra quote books that we have in the Bible,
right,
should really be there.
Right.
I know that's probably, you could do a whole topic on this.
You could. But suffice it to say, they've been there for a long time, and they were there for about 1,500 years until, really, this goes back to Luther. He kind of excised them out because there were things in them that were at variance with what he now believed as a new Protestant or a new protester, as it were. And, of course, one of those, he would not want 2 Maccabees 12 in there because that would involve praying for the dead, indulgences, and purgatory. So he wanted to avoid that. Had he had his way, he would have gotten rid of James, 2 Peter, Hebrews, the book of Revelation. You know, I mean, where does that stop? At that point, where is your authority coming from? You know, everybody just has at their own whim and wish what is convenient and inconvenient just to take out of the Bible. I mean, that seems a little odd. And if they were there for 1,500 years, that means everybody for 1,500 years was wrong on including them. I mean, none of it makes any sense. It really doesn't. And there's some really interesting things in those seven books. It's not just seven books. It's also six extra chapters in Esther. It is two extra chapters in Daniel plus 66 extra verses in Daniel chapter 3. So it's not just it's up and above that even. And at the end of the day, the difference between them and you is real simple. Authority. One word. Authority. Where do you get your authority? Where do they get their authority? Well, you get your authority from the magisterium and, you know, and tradition and sacred scripture. They get it from themselves. Each individual, you have a lot of popes in Protestantism. Each individual becomes their own pope, for lack of a better way to explain it. But yeah, you're right. You could talk forever on it and give examples. And did Jesus quote from those books? They're not in the Hebrew Bible. It's not just that they're not in the Protestant Bible. They're not in the Hebrew Bible. And I know from talking to the rabbi why they're not in the Hebrew Bible, because at the time when the Old Testament canon was being formed, there were no copies of any of those seven books that were in Hebrew. So there's no way they're going to put a copy of a Bible in their Hebrew Bible that's not in Hebrew. Now, since the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls in 1947, some, though not all, some of them have been discovered Hebrew copies. They just did not have them then, so they're not going to make the cut. Johnny come lately, it just won't work. So that's a good question, though. It's a hard question to answer quickly, though, you're right, but it's still a good question. Yes?
Could I ask you to repeat the questions?
Oh, sure.
if you were just a little bit louder, I would catch about half of that.
Okay, sorry about that. The question was, she has a Protestant friend, and what always comes up is the conflict between Protestants and Catholics on how many books should be in the Bible. As you know, Protestants have 66 and we have 73. So therein lies the difference. Or as I like to say, they have Bible light. You know, it's one way to look at it, I guess. So let's talk a little bit. And again, if you have questions at any point, just raise your hand or clarification or what have you. One thing I want to talk about tonight is something I've spent enormous amounts of time looking into, and that is typology. And is it a legitimate way to interpret the Bible? I would assure you it absolutely is a legitimate way to interpret the Bible. You cannot read the early church fathers and not look at all kinds of things that they are resigning to typological significance. Well, first of all, what is a type? That's probably should define our term, shouldn't we? We need to do that. So a type, very simply, is something, a person, place, or a thing that corresponds to something else. For example, we are told in Romans 5:14 that Adam was a type, and that the word is actually in that text, tupos, that Adam is a type of Christ. Well, there must be some correlation between the two for one to be a type of the other. The way, if you want to be really technical, Adam would be the type, Jesus would be the antitype. Or Noah's Ark would be the type, baptism would be the antitype. That's the technical language that theologians love to use. And you know theologians love to use fancy words. I guess it makes them feel good or something, I don't know. But they're just words at the end of the day. So that's what a type is. And we have those in the New Testament. Jesus himself said that in John 3:14, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. Well, now we have to think this one through. What do you mean by that? Obviously, the story goes back to Numbers 21, where the children of Israel were griping against the leadership of Moses, or whatever they were griping about at that given moment, and God sent snakes out to bite them. Now, a quick aside, the word for snake there is nahash in Hebrew. It is the same Hebrew word for serpent in the Garden of Eden. And these aren't monstrous creatures. They're just regular snakes that we have all experienced at some point in our lives. So they bit them. They begin to die. They begin to get sick. And Moses, pleads with God, tells him to put up a serpent upon a pole. Isn't that interesting? I hope that wasn't mine. Oh, because that's my ring.
It's my ring, too.
Is it? Yeah, everybody looks at their phone. Everybody has the same ring. What's interesting about that passage to me is that the remedy for their sin is that which bit them. That gets overlooked a lot for some reason. I'm not sure why, but that to me, that would just jump off the page. That which bit them now has become the remedy. Almost the poison becomes the cure, so to speak. Well, what's going on there? I mean, that does seem a little odd that the serpent bites them, and serpents do not have a good resume in the Old or the New Testament, so they bite the people. And they're told to put up a serpent upon a pole. And those people who look upon that serpent on the pole, if they look, they will live. Think about it. What was it that got humanity into trouble? Human beings. So when God decided to send a remedy, a cure for that, he sends himself in the form of what? A human being. There's where the connection is. So now you look at it and go, oh, it's one of those oh moments. And that is a perfect example of a type. Types never fit perfectly, but they fit well enough that you do have that oh, whoa, wow moment type of a thing. I'll give you a couple other examples of types. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 5:7, for even Christ our Passover is sacrificed for us. So there must be some connection between the Passover and Jesus Christ. As there was a connection between the incident about them being bitten and the snake and the serpent, there must be a connection between Passover and Jesus. Because just saying that, I really haven't told you, or anyone hasn't told you anything. Just said you Christ our Passover. It's a nice Bible verse, makes a good Hallmark card. But I haven't really told you anything. What's the real connection? Well, when you read the Levitical sacrifices in the first five chapters of Leviticus, and there are five different ones, as you know, And someone, you know, may say, well, why five? Jesus died once. He was one sacrifice. Why do you have to have five sacrifices in the Old Testament? And I would argue one of the reasons for that is because the depths of what Christ does in his act of redemption is so complex and so multi and polyvalent that it takes five different sacrifices to really get the full flavor of what he did in one. That's my best guess anyway. Oh, well, the very first sacrifice, a burnt offering. Bad, bad translation right off the bat. Not burnt offering. Let's go with ascension offering. It's a much more better translation from the Hebrew. Well, one thing we're told is that the animal must be without spot and blemish. Very words that Peter uses about Jesus in 1 Peter chapter 2. He's a lamb without spot or blemish. So there's a connection. And if you read Exodus 12 carefully, and one of the things I really try to stress when I talk about the Bible ever, pay attention to the details because they mean everything. I would never say the devil is in the details in this particular case, but certainly there's a lot of interesting things in the details. In Exodus 12, before they picked a lamb that was going to be the sacrifice, they would put it inside of a pen, and they would watch it for 4 days to see if there was anything wrong with it. They would check it every single day. And then once they did, after 4 days, if there was no spot, no blemish, it was a good sacrifice, they would offer that lamb up as the sacrifice. Well, fast forward to the New Testament. Jesus arrives in Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. For the next 4 days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, before he's crucified, the religious establishment peppers him with question after question after question. Why? Is he really the real deal? Is he really the Messiah? Is he really this lamb, so-called, without spot and blemish? Well, guess what? He was. After 4 days, there comes a point where they asked him a question. He answered it. He turns the tables on them. He asked them a question. They couldn't answer it. And the text tells us from that day forward, they never asked him another question. At that point, after 4 days, he has been interrogated. He has been scrutinized, as it were. And guess what? The sacrifice has been established that he is without spot, he is without blemish, even though he's trumped up on false charges. And the real guarantee of what I just said is from an odd character, Pontius Pilate of all people. And what did Pontius Pilate say 3 times? Remember in Hebrew, there's no good, better, and best. You have to say it 3 times to get your ultimate point across. And 3 times Pilate says, I find no fault in him. Now the lamb can be offered up as a sacrifice. So it's a wonderful comparison of the Old Testament Passover, Paschal sacrifice, and how that connects to Jesus. Jesus becomes the antitype of the type of the Old Testament. So it is a legitimate way. Some people have a real problem with typology. They say, well, people just make types out of anything. Sure, but I'm not willing to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think just because some people pervert it, I'm not going to toss it overboard. I think it's legitimate. I think it's a wonderful way to interpret the Bible. To be sure, you do have to be careful. Here's the thing. Jesus said in John chapter 5 that Moses wrote of me. Okay. That means Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Well, I challenge you. Read all 187 chapters and see if you find the name Jesus in any of them. You will not. So what on earth did Moses mean, or did Jesus mean when he said Moses wrote of me? Because I don't see Moses saying a word about Jesus. Well, it's in the typology. That's where he writes about him. In fact, in Luke 24 on the road to Emmaus, where he's talking to those two individuals, remember at one point in Luke 24:44, Jesus said, and beginning with Moses, and through the Psalms, he expounded the scriptures to those two individuals, the things concerning himself. In other words, he takes a tour on the entire Tanakh, on the entire Old Testament, and pointing out passage after passage, example after example, of where they're really talking about him. I mean, for example, read Psalm 16. Peter quotes Psalm 16 on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2. And he tells us, when he quotes Psalm 16, that David was talking about Jesus. Now, if you read Psalm 16, if I read Psalm 16, we can read it until the lake of fire freezes 15 feet thick. And I guarantee you, you're never going to think, oh, yeah, that must be Jesus. No, you're never going to think that. How do we know that it was talking about Jesus? Because Peter told us. That's how we know. It's the same. And that works across the board every single time. So typology is a real legitimate way to interpret the Bible. The early church fathers made a lot of headway with this, and it's very popular. Another, and certainly you've experienced this. Have you ever been reading the four Gospels and Jesus is talking? And you won't want to say it because you almost think it's blasphemous. It's not. But I guarantee you've thought it. You're reading and you go, why is he beating around the bush? Just say it. It's like, you know, and you may say, well, he's talking in parables, because he usually was talking in parables. What we don't understand a lot of the times, and I think the best example, there's a word for it, remez, R-E-M-E-Z. It was a Jewish way of teaching then. Trust me, I said it with the rabbi, it's still a way of teaching today. It's where the word remez in Hebrew means to hint. And Jesus is constantly hinting, but not telling us exactly what it means. Best example ever, and it's the most famous Bible story ever. In so much that every Jesus movie gets this scene in it, even if it doesn't fit. Mel Gibson, who is covering the last 18 hours in the life of Jesus, he's going to squeeze it in there, even though it does not fit one iota. And how does he do it? Flashback. Let's get a flashback. We'll get the woman taken into adultery story in there somehow, some way. It's a story that you find in John chapter 7, verses 53 through chapter 8, verse 11. And it doesn't always appear in John's gospel in the Greek text. It's what they call in Greek a floating text. Sometimes it's in Luke. Sometimes it's in John. You never know where this thing's going to pop up. It is somewhat of a late addition to a lot of the manuscripts as well. Though if you're Catholic, there's no quibbling about it, because at the Council of Trent, they decided that scripture. So for a Catholic, you can't go, well, was it? No, it was. Game over. The council said it was, so I guess it is. But here's what's interesting. Don't you find it odd that they bring this woman to Jesus, who apparently has been caught in the act of adultery, though apparently the guys get off scot-free. But here's the woman, and they drag her in front of Jesus, trying to trick him, not because they care about truth, not because they care about justice. They're trying to trick him. And what does he do? It would be like you coming up to me. Let's say at the end you come up here, and I think you're going to buy a book. And so I should be very accommodating, grateful, thankful. But instead, you're standing there waiting, and I'm doing this. I mean, what are you going to think? Dude, what is your problem? Is what I'd be thinking. Like, are you kidding me? Jesus stoops and begins to diddle on the ground a couple of times. Not once, but twice. Now, I'm glad the Bible was brought up, because I'm going to need it now. So, we need to give a little background. And there's an explanation for why he did what he did. I hope it's, some translations do not have a good translation. I'm really hoping this is. Nope, not a good one. That's okay. I'll retranslate as we go through. Anyway, the background in chapter 7, it says, on that last day, the great day of the feast. What does that mean? Well, there's only one feast that applies to, and that would be the Feast of Tabernacles. So we know what feast it was. And what does Jesus say? After it says, on that last day, the great day of the feast, he said, out of your belly shall flow rivers of living waters, fresh water, spring water. And they reject him. They want nothing to do with it. Well, during the real Feast of Tabernacles, what the priest would do is he would take some type of a jar of some sort, and they would walk down in like a procession. They'd walk down to the Pool of Siloam, and he would, because the Pool of Siloam was spring water, living water, fresh water. He would dip it in there, walk back up to the temple, and he would just pour it on the ground, which that's going to make some people a little angry, because it was scarce, and so why are you wasting water just dumping it on the ground? And Jesus takes the place of that. He's saying, I am your living water. Pretty much says the same thing to the woman of the well in John 4, does he not? Pretty much almost verbatim in John 4:14, if I got the address right. Anyway, after they have rejected him as to being the real living water, and the woman is standing there, supposedly caught in the act of adultery, he begins to write on the ground. Now, I think he's engaging in remez at that point. He's engaging in hinting, because they've rejected him. Now, I'm going to have to retranslate this as we go through. But in Jeremiah 17:13, which they would have been probably well aware of this passage, says, O hope of Israel, Lord, all who forsake you shall be put to shame, and those who have forsaken me I will write their names on the ground because they have forsaken the source of living waters. There's no way that the Jews of his day would have escaped that one. They would have known, oh, Jeremiah the prophet, got it. What is he saying? By simply writing on the ground, that, by the way, that's not what I wrote in my book. I have a whole different explanation in the book. Not one that's at variance with this. It's just certainly another plausible interpretation. I think by writing on the ground, he is condemning them, which he did all through his public ministry. So I think that's what's going on there. And I think you have to be aware of the idea of remez when Jesus is teaching, or any Jew is teaching for that matter. Sometimes I get frustrated with Paul, though not as much. Like, would you just cut to the chase, please? And often they do not, and we just have to be a little more familiar with the culture and bring ourselves up to speed, as it were.
There's some people that say that he was writing their sins in the on the ground.
That makes for a really good homily. Yeah. Just don't know if it's true. And I say that literally. I don't know. What I just said is my explanation, because I think the passage in Jeremiah certainly fits it. I mean, to a T. The living waters writing on the ground, it all fits contextually. At the end of the day, I mean, in my book, I think I suggest that he wrote twice. Excuse me, and he would have been writing on the stone pavement of the temple, and that kind of harkens back to the Ten Commandments. He's the one who wrote, thou shalt not commit adultery, and you're telling me, you know, that type of thing. That's kind of what, which may be true, I don't know. At least I think either one of those are very plausible interpretations, and sometimes that's the best that you have. Whatever's going on, Jesus is either rude or we're missing something, because let's be honest, that is kind of rude. I mean, you just start as if no one's talking to you. But that's, I don't think he's being rude. I mean, really, that can't be the answer to that. You know, now we have a rude Jesus. That does not fit the four Gospels that any of us know. Any other questions before I go on? I'm going to say some things about Genesis. Okay, Genesis is the first, the word Torah is the first letter of an acronym that the Jews used to describe their, what we would call an Old Testament. They were never called an Old Testament because that would imply a new one, and they don't believe that. But the word that they use is called Tanakh. And keep in mind, there are no vowels in Hebrew, so it's literally T-N-K if you want to transliterate it. T stands for Torah. N stands for Nevi'im. Prophets, and Ketuvim would be the K. That would be the writings like Psalms, Proverbs, Song of Solomon, books like that. So if you want to say Tanakh from now on instead of Old Testament, you're in good company. That would be a legitimate terminology to use. And it starts off in the book of Genesis. All kinds of conflicts come up. And when I hear the questions that some people ask, sometimes I just shake my head, not in a condescending manner, but in a manner that can't possibly be right. What always comes up when you read the first two chapters of Genesis? Oh, we have conflicting creation stories, don't we? No, we do not have conflicting creation stories, not at all. But you have to step back a little bit and ask, and I think ask some questions for that to work. I ran this by the rabbi when we were studying Hebrew. I said, Rabbi, do you think there's two creation stories? He says, there are two creation stories. I said, yeah, that's what I read. He said, but they do not conflict. I said, well, on the first one, you have animals made and then humans, and the second one, you have humans made and then animals. And I said, that's just one example that comes up. So there seems, he says, yeah, because you're thinking like Aristotle. Quit thinking like Aristotle. Okay, I guess I will quit that then. Sorry. I said, how would you like me to think? He says, like Moses. He said, think like Moses. Think like, well, he never said Moses. He always said Moshe. Think like Moshe. Which is a quick aside, by the way. Moses is not a Hebrew name. It is an Egyptian name. And you know that without realizing that you know it. What's the most famous pharaoh that you know of? And don't say King Tut. What's the most famous pharaoh? He would have been the pharaoh probably at the time of the Exodus. Ramses II. In that word Ramses is Moses, because in, you would say, the correct way to pronounce it would be Ra Moshe. That's Ramses. So Moshe is just an Egyptian name that was given him, because remember, he was raised in Pharaoh's court, so it does make a certain amount of sense. So the rabbi says, you got to think like Moses. I says, okay, Rabbi, I'm trying to follow your thought here, Rabbi, so what exactly do you mean? And he said, because here, and by that point I knew enough Hebrew. He says, we're going to go through this. So we read Genesis 1 in Hebrew. He says, what do you think after reading it in Hebrew? I said, well, it seems very beautiful Hebrew. He says, it is. Keep going. I said, well, it seemed almost poetic. He goes, bingo. It is. It's Hebrew poetry. He says, because have you ever noticed that day one and day four go together? Day two and day five go together? Day three and day six go together? Day one, you have light. Day four, you have the sun, the moon, the stars. Day two, you have the sky above and the water beneath. What do you have in day five? Fish and fowl. What do you have on day three? Dry land and vegetation. What do you have on day six? Land, animals, and human beings to occupy that land and the vegetation. It's almost like someone built a house, and now people are going to occupy that house. That's really how it's set up, he said. And it's very beautiful, what he called Hebrew symmetrical parallelism. I said, well, yeah, that's not going to go over if I try to explain that to somebody. So I'll just say it just works. We'll go with that if you don't mind. And I think he was right. What you have in Genesis 1 is a macrocosm view of creation. What you have in Genesis 2 is a microcosm. It's in the details in Genesis 2. And I think in Genesis 2, if you want a chronology, if you want a literal approach, you're going to be much better off doing that if you read Genesis 2. Genesis 1 has no interest in that. Genesis 1 is written in beautiful Hebrew poetry to get two points across to the reader. One, God is the originator of all life, and that human beings are the crown jewel of God's creation. That's what you should get out of Genesis 1. And then when you get to Genesis 2, then things get a little interesting. And of course, the Hebrews, as I said last time, they love to play on words. Out of Ish comes Isha. Out of Adam's side comes Eve. But she's not called Eve until Genesis 3:20. She's never called Eve. She's never called Hevel until sin enters into the human condition, which, of course, Eve means the mother of all living, which will soon take place in Genesis 4. So there are so many things going on in those first few chapters of Genesis. Whenever I teach Genesis, it takes forever to get through those first three chapters because they're so dense and so compact. When Adam and Eve, Adam is told in Genesis 2 to guard the garden. There's only one question you should ask. Why? Why would I guard the garden? No sin's been committed. What's going on? It's a rumble strip to get you to stop. Whoa, stop. Whoa, something's going on here. And what you don't know is because you haven't read Genesis 3 yet, if you're reading it for the first time. Then you read Genesis 3, what do you have? All of a sudden, this serpentine creature appears that you do not know it's Satan until Revelation 12. You never will know that that's Satan until Revelation 12. There are hints that something has gone awry here, but we're not exactly sure what it is. The serpent seems to be almost like a trickster, more than anything, trying to lie, trying to deceive. And when you get to Revelation 12, we're told that the great serpent, the dragon, is the devil. We're told that then. But the story in Genesis 3 is amazing because, one, there's this continuous trying to pass the buck. Eve sins, and where's Adam at when she sins? We know. Moses tells us. He is standing right next to her during the whole thing and never speaks up once. Not once. When it's finally obvious that sin has occurred, God tries to immediately get a confession out of them, and it doesn't work. I love what Adam says. Adam does not say, the woman made me do it. You know what Adam says? The woman who you gave me made me do it. In other words, he's blaming. That is better. Thank you. Very nice. So it's not just the woman made me do it, but the woman who you gave me. Like, thanks a lot, God. Way to go. Set me up. And what does Eve say? Well, the serpent tricked me. What's Adam say? The woman tricked me. The only one who doesn't give an excuse, oddly enough, is a serpent. That would be the one you'd expect to give the better excuse of anyone. He just owns up. Or actually, he doesn't really own up. He just gets condemned. And then you have maybe at this point the most famous passage in the Old Testament, Genesis 3:15, where it's the curse of the serpent. And God tells the serpent that I will put enmity or tension between you and the woman and between your seed and her seed. He, she, we don't know, will crush your head. And in the process of that, his heel will be crushed. There's a lot going on there. First of all, the seed of the woman. That doesn't work as much as I think we know enough about biology to know without any further details, the seed of the woman's not going to work. It's not called the seed of the woman. Men have that. Women don't have that. So that is believed by most theologians to be a remez, a hint of the virgin birth. But it's not just that. It's the fact that God told the serpent when he cursed him something about the future of humanity. That there was going to be a woman who someone was going to emerge from her loins, didn't say when, but it was going to be a male descendant that would emerge from her loins that would crush the head of the serpent. Now, Jerome translates that she would crush the head of the serpent. Jerome is almost alone in this, by the way. The reason why Jerome said she and others have said he, I would be so tempted to write on that, but I'd never be forgiven, so I won't. If I were to write he and she in Hebrew, if that was a whiteboard, you couldn't tell the difference. They are identical. The only difference is where do you decide to put the vowel points? To say he in Hebrew, you would say she. To say she, you would say who. That's how you actually say it. And so because there's no way to really tell contextually whether that would be he or she, but Jerome, being a good Catholic, probably decides on she, and now I'm guessing, I don't know why he picked she over he, but because so many women begin to emerge in the Old Testament who are going around crushing male skulls. Women love to crush skulls in the Old Testament. Ladies, I don't know what's going on there, but you have game. And I mean very early on. There's a few guys who get into the fray, but Jael, or Yael in Hebrew, puts a tent peg through Sisera's skull. And when you guys take prisoners, you take prisoners. I mean, she's whipping out a tent peg and puts it through his skull so ferociously, the peg goes into the ground on the other side of the skull.
Yeah.
And then there's the famous passage in Judges where the woman drops a millstone on Abimelech's head. Man, boy, hell hath no fury like a psychotic woman scorned, let me tell you. Then you have the famous book of Judith, where Judith cuts off the head. You guys are done dropping millstones. You're just chopping heads off now. Chops the head off of Holofernes. They're dropping like flies, for goodness sakes. So you have that. That may be why St. Jerome chose she over he. There's really no reason to quibble. Either one would work, to be honest with you. So I'll leave that up to you. But that skull thing comes all the way through. David cuts off the head of Goliath and takes it with him. He has a souvenir. That head pops up later on down the road, as does his sword, for goodness sakes. In so much that Goliath, the root, the same cognate, the same root for Goliath is the same root for Golgotha, skull. Isn't that amazing? So when you get to the skull, and I think I may have mentioned this the last time I was here, when you get to the Jesus crucified at Golgotha, Calvary, well, of course, Calvary is Calvarium in Latin, that'd be skull too. But Golgotha, which means skull, the imagery is striking, is it not? Jesus is elevated above Golgotha. He's elevated above the skull. His feet are right close to stepping on the skull once again. This theme is from Genesis 3:15 to the crucifixion site. So connecting all those kinds of dots is really interesting. I'm going to say something about, I'd mentioned the book of Acts earlier, about the quotation from Psalm 16 that Peter quotes in chapter 2. Before that, he quotes from Joel chapter 2, earlier in the same chapter. But when you think, here's a, since this is Torah-based, in Leviticus 23, there are different feasts that are named that are holy days of obligation. That's where we get it, by the way. We get our holy days of obligation, that whole notion, we get it from Leviticus 23 and the Jewish liturgical calendar. Well, there were three feasts that if you're a Jew, you had to go to if you were male and at the age where you were accountable. Passover and Pentecost, they were spring feasts, and then in the fall, there was the Feast of Tabernacles. And the Feast of Pentecost, of course, that appears in Acts chapter 2, as you know, the day of Pentecost, we call it, which was 50 days after Passover. That's why it's called Pentecost, because that's what Pentecost means in Greek, fellas. 50. Thank you for sharing. Pentecost means 50. So 50 days after Passover, you're at the Feast of Pentecost. And it was a barley feast. It was a harvest feast. It was in the spring. So the high priest would take these barley sheaves and wave them before the Lord, praising God for the great harvest that they had. But here's what's weird about that. In Acts chapter 2, any idea who the high priest would have been at the time doing that? I remember the day I saw this, I thought, oh, that is just absolutely creepy. Who is the high priest? It's the same high priest who condemned Jesus to death at his trial, Joseph Caiaphas.
Okay.
He has not gone anywhere. It's the same high priest. Whenever I think about that, I think of what Jesus said about the religious Jewish leaders. On the outside, they're white as sepulchers, but inside, they're full of dead men's bones. There's Joseph Caiaphas in a nutshell. I'm not going to repeat what I said about the archaeological discovery, because if you're here last time, I'm just repeating myself. But think of the scenario at this Feast of Pentecost. You had to go to it. So that's why there's a lot of people in Jerusalem at the time of this great feast. The Holy Spirit descends. And we are told that all of a sudden these cloven tongues of fire are sitting on the heads of all 120 people in the upper room. Well, as I said before when I was here, a lot of this is just replay of the Old Testament. Where have we seen that before? Where fire was on anything and yet it didn't consume it. Because if fire is on top of our skulls, we should be going, ouch. Nothing is consumed any more than the burning bush is consumed in Exodus chapter 3. So it's a replay of the burning bush story. But even more than that, I think to understand Acts chapter 2 and that transfer of the Jewish culture into the New Testament, we have to remember what the Apostle Paul said. A Jew from the tribe of Benjamin said that we are living sacrifices. The language that is used in Acts chapter 2 on the day of Pentecost is language used if you're going to perform a sacrifice. The fire is put upon the sacrifice. Any sacrifice, for the most part, was consumed with fire at some point. So these people now become altars. They become living sacrifices. And what happens as a result of this? They begin to speak in these different tongues. That's the Tower of Babel in reverse. It's also the Tower of Babel in reverse in other ways. At the Tower of Babel, they were trying to reach up to heaven. On the day of Pentecost, heaven came down to them. So things get just turn topsy-turvy, every aspect of that. And then there's 17 nations that are mentioned. Why mention those 17 nations? There's no way you can read that and not think, okay, that came out of a dark alley. Why are you mentioned, by the way, oh, there was Phrygians there, and there were people from Pamphylia, and there were people from Cappadocia. Okay, I get it, but why? Because at the Tower of Babel, which happens in Genesis 11, if you read Genesis 10, you have 70 nations that are mentioned. But Genesis 10 can't take place before Genesis 11. Because in Genesis 11, one tongue, one place. Genesis 10, 70 tongues, different places. So everything in the Old Testament is not always neatly tied and in chronological order. It just isn't. So you have on the day of Pentecost this, I think, reflection back to the Genesis 10 table of nations. I would also say that those nations in Acts 2 are a foreshadowing of where the book of Acts is going to take you. Every one of those nations are going to be reached out to at some point in the book of Acts. Read Acts 14, there you have Pamphylia covered, you have Phrygia covered, and just read the rest of the book of Acts, all 28 chapters, and the rest of them are at some point covered as well. So there's all kinds of connections between the Old Testament and the New, and to me, it makes it a terribly, terribly exciting book. One more thing, and then we'll take a break. What are these people doing when the Holy Spirit descends? They're doing something. What is it that they're doing? Anybody remember what they're doing on the day of Pentecost? All 120, one place, one accord, Mary leading the way. They're praying. And what are they accused of? They're accused of being drunk. Peter defends them and says, really, it's 9 o'clock in the morning. What are the odds we'd all be drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning, all 120 of us? I would ask you, where have you seen that before? Where have you seen before where someone was accused of being drunk when they were simply praying to God? And when this person is accused, she says, nothing was going in. The only thing that was going on was something was coming out. I was praying to God out of my soul. It was going out. Nothing was going in. Eli and Hannah. Hannah's praying, and Eli is so far from God in 1 Samuel chapter 1 that he can't tell the difference between someone praying and someone being drunk. That's not a good priest. You don't want that. Not good. And I think what the writer, which in this case is Luke of the book of Acts, is saying, look, this is the story of Hannah all over again. Hannah prayed for a reversal in Israel, and it didn't happen. And guess what? It's not going to happen now either. And it almost like, by having that happen, it's almost like this death sentence is now hanging hanging over their heads. And all the Hophnis and the Phineases and the Elis are no better than they were at the time of Jesus. You have a very, very corrupt priesthood. And so what is really going on here is that I think Judaism, once again, is being being condemned for a while. And by the way, they're told that they're drinking new wine. It's not the normal word for wine. Oinos would be the Greek word for wine, but this is glucose. Glucose. In other words, this is like Boone's Farm? Not good. Bad. Bad stuff. You're not in Rome drinking really, you know, sophisticated wine. This is junk, to be honest with you. And it's almost like Peter gives him a little, like, really, if we're going to drink, we're going to drink the good stuff. That's just junk, you know. So who knows what they're saying. In any event, we'll take why don't we take, how long of a break do we take?
10 minutes.
About 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll do that.